Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're diving into a really fascinating story, the history and the science behind a legendary material.
Damascus steel.
Exactly, Damascus steel. Known, you know, for centuries for that incredible sharpness, that flexibility, and the amazing patterns on the surface.
Yeah.
But like a lot of legends, well, the name doesn't quite tell the whole story, does it?
No, it really doesn't.
What if the real heart of it, the origin, wasn't actually Damascus? What if it started, say, thousands of miles east in ancient India?
Well, that's exactly the mystery, isn't it? That's what we're digging into, because while those famous blades, yeah, they were often forged and traded in places like Damascus.
Right. Major center.
The actual steel itself, that unique crucible steel that made them possible, that came from somewhere else entirely, developed much, much earlier and much further east.
Okay. So our mission for this deep dive then is to kind of pull together all these amazing sources you've given us. We've got historical accounts, archaeology, even modern science.
A real mix, yeah. Historical texts, archaeological reports, metallurgical analysis.
It's quite a stack. And we're going to synthesize it all to really highlight India's crucial and, frankly, pioneering role in developing Wootz steel. And hopefully set the record straight on how it connects to those blades we call Damascus steel.
Yeah, we'll follow the trail. Right from the start in those ancient Indian forges, see how it traveled the world along those trade routes, how it changed warfare, culture.
And how baffled scientists for ages.
Exactly. And still does in some ways. It's a story of innovation, trade, craftsmanship, and just enduring legend.
Okay, let's jump right in then.
Yeah.
Where does this incredible story actually begin? Where's ground zero?
It definitively begins in ancient India. Specifically, we're talking about the southern regions of the Indian subcontinent.
Southern India.
Yeah. Wootz steel was genuinely pioneering. It was one of the earliest forms, maybe the earliest form, of ultra-high carbon crucible steel developed anywhere. And based on the archaeology, we can pin its development to around the mid-first millennium BC.
Mid-first millennium BC. Wow. So we're talking, what, over 2,500 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
That's some serious metallurgical sophistication way back then.
It really is. And it wasn't just a fluke occurrence. The evidence points to specific regions being central to this.
Which regions exactly? Any specific sites we know about?
Absolutely. The sources are pretty clear. Key areas in southern India, regions that roughly match up with modern-day Tamilakam, parts of Andhra Pradesh and Karnataka, these were the hot spots.
Right.
And archaeology has backed this up at specific sites. Kodumanal, for instance, is considered a really significant early site for iron and steel production. Later on, other places became major production and export hubs. Think areas around Mysore, the Golconda region, and specific name sites like Konasamudram, Nirmal, Melsiruvalur, Tintini, Machnoor.
So quite a network. These weren't just isolated little workshops.
No, not at all. It seems to have been a larger, pretty sophisticated system.
Yeah.
You know, sourcing the right raw materials, the actual production, and then the trade networks to move the finished product.
Okay, so how do they actually do it? How did they make this unique steel back then? You mentioned the crucible process. It sounds almost like, well, alchemy.
It definitely has that feel, especially when you read some of the old descriptions of what went into the pot. But at its core, it was a remarkably advanced crucible steelmaking process for its time. The basic idea, like you said, is mixing your starting materials inside a sealed container, the crucible.
A clay pot, essentially.
A specially designed clay pot, yeah. Highly refractory. And then you heat that sealed pot to incredibly high temperatures for a long time. The aim wasn't just melting the iron. It was about getting carbon to diffuse into the iron under really controlled conditions to create a specific high carbon alloy that would actually melt or get semi-molten inside.
Okay, so what went into this alchemical pot? What were the key ingredients for Wootz?
All right, the main things were very carefully selected, iron and a carbon source. The iron had to be clean pieces of wrought iron or what's called bloom iron. But crucially, it had to be low in phosphorus and sulfur.
Why was that so important? Low phosphorus and sulfur.
Because those elements are real troublemakers in steel. They cause something called hot short cracking. Basically, the steel becomes brittle and just crumbles when you try to forge it hot. So getting rid of those impurities right at the start, or using iron that was naturally low in them, was absolutely critical to end up with an ingot you could actually work with.
Makes sense. And the carbon source?
That was usually hardwood charcoal crushed up finely. made from specific types of wood, it seems. Inside that sealed hot crucible, the carbon from this charcoal would literally soak into the iron.
So the charcoal wasn't just fuel, it was actually changing the iron's chemistry.
Precisely. It was the ingredient providing the carbon that turned the iron into high-carbon steel. And they were aiming for a specific range. The metallurgy suggests the sweet spot was typically between about 1.2 and 1.8% carbon, sometimes up to 2.1%. That's really high for steel.
Ultra high carbon steel, yeah. Okay, so iron, charcoal, anything else? You mentioned a spice earlier.
Ah, yes. This is where it gets really interesting from a modern science perspective. The ancient smiths must have figured this out through trial and error, but there were tiny amounts of other elements involved. Think of them as metallurgical spices, trace elements like vanadium, maybe molybdenum.
Vanadium? Where would they get that from?
Often from naturally occurring materials mixed into the charge, maybe specific types of magnetite sand, or potentially even from the ash of certain plants they used. And the research shows that even minuscule amounts, we're talking like 0.02%, were incredibly important.
Just 0.02%. Why would such a tiny amount matter so much?
It sounds crazy, but it played this vital role in controlling how the steel's microstructure formed as it cooled down in the crucible. And, just as importantly, how that structure behaved later when the smith was forging it. These trace elements essentially acted like pins, pinning the plates of cementite, that's iron carbide, that formed during cooling.
Cementite. That's the hard part of the steel.
Extremely hard, yes, but also brittle on its own. These trace elements helped keep the cementite plates really thin and aligned them in parallel within the softer iron matrix. This specific structure, this alignment, was key to everything. The steel's strength, its surprising flexibility, its ability to hold that famous edge. And it was fundamental to creating the visible pattern.
So getting that tiny amount right was crucial.
Absolutely critical. Too little vanadium or molybdenum, and the pattern would be weak or cloudy. Too much, and the ingot might just crack during cooling or forging, making it totally useless. It points to this amazing level of empirical control they achieved long before anyone understood the underlying chemistry.
Incredible. What else went into the crucible? Was it just the iron, charcoal, and these trace elements?
There were usually a couple of other important additions. A flux was key, often described as crushed clear glass, maybe recycled bottle glass or quartz chips. They'd sprinkle this on top of the metal charge inside the crucible.
And what did the flux do?
It serves several purposes. It melts relatively early as things heat up, forming this molten viscous layer on top. This layer helps absorb impurities, slag from the iron, basically cleaning the steel. It also seals the surface of the melt-off from the air inside the crucible, preventing oxygen from reacting with the hot metal.
Preventing oxidation.
Exactly, and preventing decarburization, losing carbon from the surface. It also helped dissolve other unwanted oxides, just generally led to cleaner, better steel.
Clever. And you mentioned something about dealing with leftover oxygen, too.
Yes, often a small wafer of charcoal was placed right on top of the flux layer. This would be the last bit of carbon material to burn as the crucible reached peak temperature. As it burned, it produced carbon monoxide gas, CO. The CO gas would fill any remaining space, pushing out or reacting with any last bits of oxygen and further protecting the steel surface from losing carbon at those really high temperatures. It's another layer of sophisticated process control, really.
And the heating itself. These crucibles went into special furnaces.
Right. The sources, especially some Arabic ones, mention furnaces sometimes called kür. These had to be capable of reaching and holding very high temperatures, probably at least 1250 degrees Celsius, maybe even higher. And for long periods, firing cycles of around 24 hours are often mentioned.
Why so hot? Doesn't iron melt lower than that?
Regular cast iron does, yes. But this specific ultra-high carbon steel needed those higher temperatures to fully form and homogenize within the crucible. And the crucibles themselves were engineering feats. Studies, like those on the Dakani crucibles from India, show they had to be highly refractory resistant to heat.
Right, to not melt themselves.
Exactly. They also needed to be somewhat insulating to allow the steel ingot inside to cool down slowly and correctly after the firing. And then, importantly, they had to be just brittle enough that you could carefully break the crucible open afterwards to get the precious steel ingot out without damaging it.
You mentioned earlier those really curious ingredients listed in some Arabic sources from Mazyad Biali, horseshoes and pomegranate rinds. What was going on there?
Axel.
Yeah, it does sound more like a recipe from a medieval apothecary than a blacksmith. Mazyad Biali, who was a smith in Damascus, gave this detailed recipe for charging a crucible. He specified using, I think it was 5 rattles a unit of weight, of horseshoes and nails, made from a particular type of iron he called narmahin.
Okay, so specific iron feedstock.
Yes. Then he added specific weights of minerals like rusuptage, something called golden marcasite stone, and brittle magnesia. And then came the really odd stuff from our view. Bundles containing things like ilalage, that's my robolan, a type of fruit pomegranate rinds, salt and oyster shells or pearl shells, all crushed together. He specified a certain weight per bundle and one bundle per crucible.
Wow. Horseshoes, fruit, shells. It's hard to connect that directly to legendary steel. Any idea what those organic bits and minerals were doing?
Well, it really highlights how ancient empirical knowledge worked. They knew what worked, even if they didn't know why, in modern chemical terms. The organic materials, the myrobalan and pomegranate rinds, would definitely be sources of carbon, supplementing the charcoal.
Okay, that makes sense. The minerals and shells, they likely acted as additional fluxes, helping to purify the melt, or perhaps they were the source of some of those crucial trace elements we talked about. Certain plant ashes or shells can contain traces of vanadium or molybdenum or other things that might have subtly influenced the final chemistry. The sources also sometimes distinguish between the initial iron, the narmahin, and its purified form, suggesting they had preparation steps too. It's this fascinating mix of practical metallurgy and what seems almost ritualistic, all aimed at getting that very specific result.
So after this whole long, complex process, firing, cooling, what do they actually pull out of the broken crucible?
The end result was a solid ingot of high-carbon steel. They were often disc-shaped, sometimes called cakes or pucks. We have actual examples from archaeology, like that amazing hoard of 60 ingots found at Kanasamudram back in 2016.
60 of them.
Together. Yeah, an incredible find. And they were remarkably consistent, averaged about 1 kilogram each, which might link up to an old Indian weight unit, maybe the seer. And crucially, these ingots often showed a pattern right on the cast surface, a radial dendritic pattern.
Dendritic, like tree branches.
Exactly. Formed as the metal solidified from the outside in within the crucible, this pattern showed the underlying structure was there right from the start.
So that famous swirling pattern, the Firin, as the Arabic sources called it, was already visible on the ingot.
The potential for the pattern, the basic structure, was absolutely set during the casting and slow cooling inside that crucible. That dendritic structure, those tree-like crystals of austenite, the high-temperature form of steel growing inwards, that was the foundation. As it cooled further, the high carbon forced cementite to form within and between these dendrites. But the really visible, famous pattern, the Firin, that only became fully clear after the ingot was skillfully forged into a blade and then etched, usually with some kind of acid.
Ah, so forging and etching were needed to reveal it.
Precisely. The etching process attacks the different microscopic phases in the steel, the softer iron-rich ferrite and the harder carbon-rich cementite at different rates. This differential etching is what brings out the underlying structure, which the forging process had already aligned and refined into those characteristic bands or swirls.
Let's get more into the science of that pattern and the steel's amazing properties. You mentioned cementite and ferrite.
Right, so Wootz is ultra-high carbon steel, remember, 1.2 to maybe 1.8% carbon, give or take. Microscopically, its structure is a mix of phases. You've got ferrite that's relatively soft, ductile iron, and then you have cementite iron carbide, Fe3C, which is incredibly hard but also quite brittle. There's also often perlite, which is itself a layered structure of ferrite and cementite. It gets its name because it can have this pearl-like shimmer under a microscope. Some even theorize it acts like a tiny photonic crystal, which is fascinating. The visible pattern we see on a finished blade comes from macroscopic sheets or bands made up of these microscopic carbides, the cementite, distributed within a matrix. That matrix might be tempered martensite or perlite in the higher carbon Wootz, or ferrite and pollite in slightly lower carbon versions. The exact structure depended on the initial ingot chemistry and, crucially, how it was cooled in the crucible and then heat treated during forging.
Now, that cast ingot with all that carbon and hard cementite sounds like it would be super brittle. How on earth did ancient smiths turn that into a blade that was not only sharp, but famously flexible too?
That transformation is where the true artistry and deep empirical knowledge of the smiths, whether they were in India, Persia, or Syria, really shines. You're right, a raw, high-carbon Wootz ingot could be extremely brittle. If you just tried to hammer it out like regular iron, especially at the wrong temperature, it would likely shatter.
So they had a secret technique.
They had an incredibly refined technique born from generations of experience. They knew they had to forge the steel within a very specific, relatively narrow temperature range. Modern science suggests somewhere around 850 degrees Celsius down to maybe 650 degrees Celsius, a sort of dull red heat, not the bright yellow or white heat you'd use for a lower carbon steel.
Why was overheating so bad?
If you heated woods too high, you'd dissolve all those carefully formed cementite structures back into the high temperature austenite phase. Then, if it cooled too quickly from that point, it could form extremely brittle structures, and yeah, it would just crumble under the hammer. They knew, somehow, not to do that.
So forging wasn't just shaping, it was a critical heat treatment, too.
Exactly. The forging was a precise thermal and mechanical process. It did more than just shape the blade. It fundamentally changed the microstructure inherited from the crucible. It took that potentially brittle cast structure and made it ductile and incredibly tough. It did this by changing the shape, the morphology of the cementite. Instead of maybe forming a brittle network along the grain boundaries, the careful hammering broke it up and either spheroidized it, turned the carbides into tiny rounded particles, or, crucially for the pattern, it aligned the carbides into those flowing bands we associate with Damascus steel. That alignment let the pattern pop when it was etched.
And the legendary sharpness, did that come from the same process, this microstructure?
Yes, very likely. Both the historical accounts and modern understanding point to something often called the micro chainsaw effect. During that careful forging, those incredibly hard microscopic carbide particles of cementite could be preferentially aligned right along the blade's edge.
Like tiny teeth.
Exactly, like microscopic serrations. Imagine these tiny, incredibly hard, almost diamond-like particles embedded in the slightly softer steel matrix, forming a super fine cutting edge. When the blade was sharpened, these hard carbides would provide the actual cutting points. This structure would not only allow for incredible initial sharpness, but also contribute significantly to the blade's ability to hold that edge, its famous edge retention.
Fascinating. And the pattern itself, the find, was it just pretty or did it mean something more to the smiths?
It seems it was both. It was definitely prized for its beauty, but the Arabic sources suggest the pattern also told the smith something about the quality or nature of the steel from that particular crucible melt. They apparently recognized different types of patterns.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they noted that if everything in the crucible melted and mixed perfectly evenly, the resulting steel might actually show no pattern when forged and etched. This steel, still high carbon and useful, might have been designated for things like files or tools, perhaps what they called shaburkin. But if there were slight variations in the melt, if things didn't mix absolutely perfectly, then different areas would etch differently, revealing the find. So the pattern wasn't just decoration added on, it was an intrinsic sign of the steel's internal structure, a direct result of that specific crucible process. Different patterns were known, named, and valued differently.
Okay, so these incredible ingots were perfected in ancient India.
Mm-hmm.
How did they make the journey from, say, South India all the way to places like Damascus and Syria? That's a huge distance.
It is, and that's the next chapter. The global journey. This involves the amazing ancient trade networks that stitched together India, the Middle East, and even parts of Europe. These unique woots ingots, these cakes or pucks, became a really valuable export commodity for India.
What routes did they take? Was it mostly by sea?
It seems to have been a combination. The ingots were produced in those southern and central Indian centers we mentioned, like Golconda or Nirmal. From places like Nirmal, which is inland in modern Telangana, they might have been transported overland, perhaps westward towards the coast. Ports in regions like Kutch in modern Gujarat were major hubs connecting India to maritime routes heading west across the Arabian Sea and also to overland caravan routes.
And Arab traders were key players.
Hugely important. Arab merchants dominated many of these Indian Ocean and overland routes for centuries. They were crucial facilitators of this trade. Sri Lanka also seems to have been an important stop, maybe a production center itself or a transshipment point. This trade was active for a very, very long time, definitely starting by the mid-first millennium BC and going strong right through the classical era, the Islamic Golden Age, and well into the medieval period. There were established trade links connecting Syrian cities, Damascus included, back to India, often via these hubs like Kutch. And we see mentions of this trade pop up in historical records across the centuries. There's that famous, though maybe debatable, account from Roman times. Quintus Curtius Rufus, writing about Alexander the Great in India around 327 BC, King Porus supposedly gifted Alexander 100 talents of bright iron ferrum candidum.
Bright iron? Could that have been woots?
It's debated. Bright iron could just mean high-quality polished iron. But the sheer quantity mentioned 100 talents, maybe around 3 tons, suggests it was something special, highly valued. And the fact it was recorded as a significant gift implies it wasn't just ordinary iron. It's tantalizing to think it might have been an early form of Indian steel, adding to this long history of metallurgical prowess.
Okay, maybe a hint there. What about later, clearer evidence?
Oh, absolutely. Much clearer evidence comes later, especially from Arab and Middle Eastern sources. Even before Islam, in the 6th and 7th centuries AD, pre-Islamic Arabic poetry mentions swords called Alhind, or Hinduani, clearly meaning Indian.
Right, indicating the origin.
Exactly. Then, during the Islamic Golden Age, you get prominent scholars explicitly confirming it. Jabir ibn Hayyar, the famous alchemist in the 8th century, mentions Indian steel. Al-Biruni, the great polymath writing in the 11th century, is very clear. He says steel from India and Sri Lanka is what's used for making swords in many parts of the Islamic world. Then you have the geographer Idrisi in the 12th century remarking on the unbeatable edge you could get from Indian steel. These aren't vague hints. They're direct statements about the source and quality of the steel being imported for weapons.
So the ingots leave India, travel these vast distances. Where they mostly end up and what happened next?
Their primary destinations were the major metalworking centers across the Middle East. Damascus in Syria became the most renowned, obviously giving its name to the final product, but other cities in Persia and elsewhere in the Islamic world were also receiving and working this Indian steel. And this is where the next layer of the legend gets built, the transformation of these raw ingots into those exquisite finished blades. The smiths in places like Damascus and Persia were absolute masters of their craft. They possessed the incredible skill needed to take these tricky, high-carbon woots ingots and forge them, using those precise heat control and hammering techniques we talked about, into finished weapons. Often the iconic curved sabers, but also straight swords, daggers, etc.
And Damascus became famous not for making the steel, but for working it.
Precisely. Damascus rose to prominence not as a steel production center, but as a major hub for forging the imported Indian woots into blades, and then as a center for trading those finished blades far and wide. The name Damask later became kind of a general term for this type of patterned crucible steel, often called bulat in Russian and Turkish areas. You might see terms like sham, which is Turkish for Syria or Damascus, indicating blades associated with that city's production style.
Okay, and this right here is the core of the big misconception, isn't it? People hearing Damascus steel and assuming the steel itself was invented or made in Damascus.
Exactly. That's the critical point that often gets lost. The name Damascus steel historically refers to the finished blades that were expertly forged and widely traded from centers like Damascus, using raw steel ingots that originated in India. It does not mean the steelmaking technology itself was Damascene.
So the name stuck to the final product's point of trade. Not its point of origin or the origin of the raw material?
Pretty much. You can see how it happened. If you were a European knight back in the Crusades or a merchant later on, you encountered these amazing swords in Damascus or through trade routes originating there. So naturally, you called them Damascus steel. The name stuck because the blades were so famous and impressive. Over time, in the West especially, that name just eclipsed the original material name, woots, and obscured its Indian roots. But the whole system, the historical sources, and the archaeology make it clear, relied fundamentally on those crucible yards in India supplying the unique ingots. The master smiths in Syria and Persia needed that specific Indian high-carbon steel because it was the only material known at the time that could be worked to produce those properties and that distinctive fire-end pattern. Some accounts even suggest Damascene smiths refused to work other steels for these top-tier blades.
Now, these blades weren't just beautiful objects. They were weapons of war. How were they actually used on the battlefield, both in India, where the skill came from, and elsewhere?
Right. In India itself, iron and steel weaponry were foundational military technology from way back, certainly from the later Vedic period, around 1000 BCE. That was a major shift. Fast forward to the Gupta period, say 4th to 6th centuries AD, Indian metallurgy sees significant advances, maybe influenced by interactions with Central Asia. The sources suggest the Gupta Empire's success was partly built on equipping its armies with high-quality swords and other steel weapons. It was part of an ongoing evolution. Now, the specific sources we have here don't give us, like battlefield reports saying the Rajput cavalry charged with woots swords at the Battle of X, but One source headline does directly link Woot's ingots from Golconda in South India to victory in many battles. That strongly implies these superior steel weapons were key assets for various Indian powers over time, whether South Indian kingdoms, Rajput warrior clans, or later the Mughal Empire. And then beyond India, once those ingots were exported and forged into blades in the Middle East, they became absolutely central to the military power of the Islamic empires, highly prized across Persia, the Levant, Central Asia.
And their fame really spread to Europe during the Crusades, right?
Dramatically so. European knights and soldiers directly encountered the effectiveness, the apparent superiority of these blades during the Crusades, roughly late 11th to late 13th centuries. That experience cemented their legendary status in the West, and their use continued in major conflicts involving later powers like the Ottoman Empire and the Persian Safavids.
What was it about them that stood out so much on the battlefield? What did people actually report?
The accounts that come down to us consistently rave about two things: incredible sharpness and a remarkable combination of flexibility and resilience, especially considering how hard the steel was. This combination really differentiated them from many contemporary European blades, which might be strong but perhaps more brittle or softer and less able to hold a keen edge. And the most vivid illustration of this reputation, even if it's likely romanticized, is that famous story popularized by Sir Walter Scott in his novel The Talisman.
Ah, yes, the Saladin and Richard the Lionheart story.
Exactly. Scott paints this picture of a contest during the Third Crusade. King Richard shows off the power of his heavy European sword by supposedly hacking through a thick iron bar. Brute force. Then Saladin takes out his curved Damascus saber, described as having this dull blue sheen. He tosses a silk cushion in the air and just lets the sword fall on it, and the cushion apparently drifts apart. Then he takes a folded shawl or veil, drapes it over the blade, and with just a smooth draw, cuts it cleanly in two.
Effortless cutting.
Effortless, precise cutting. Whether that specific scene ever happened is debatable, but the story perfectly captures the legend, the almost magical sharpness and the contrast between brute strength and refined cutting power that became associated with these blades.
It's a powerful image.
Yeah.
Did these blades have an impact beyond just their physical performance?
Oh, definitely. Their appearance alone was striking, that characteristic watery or swirling pattern, the ferrund, sometimes described with a bluish or reddish tint, as Scott poetically put it, marked with 10 millions of meandering lines. They weren't just tools. They were potent symbols of status, wealth, leadership.
Prestige items.
Absolutely. They were exchanged as high-value diplomatic gifts between rulers. Think back to that possible gift to Alexander. They became embedded in folklore and legends across multiple cultures. And you have to imagine, on a battlefield, facing an opponent wielding a weapon with that kind of reputation must have had a significant psychological impact, too. It wasn't just steel, it was legend.
So this incredible material, born in India, travels the world because legendary in the Middle East, changes warfare. What was its impact further afield, particularly on science and metallurgy back in Europe? Did it spark curiosity?
It absolutely did. The unique nature of these blades coming from the East, especially noticed after the Crusades, definitely caught the attention of European scientists and metalworkers as they entered the age of scientific inquiry. They could see this was something different, something superior in some ways to what they were commonly making.
Were there specific attempts to study it?
Yes, particularly during the Enlightenment and into the 19th century, there was considerable scientific interest. People wanted to figure out, how is this made? What gives it these properties? One of the most famous early investigators was Michael Faraday.
Faraday, the electricity guy.
The very same. In the early 19th century, he conducted some of the first systematic chemical analyses of Woot's steel samples. He was trying to unlock its compositional secrets. Other British metallurgists around that time also studied it, tried to replicate it. Often they struggled initially because they didn't fully grasp the critical importance of that ultra-high carbon content or the potential role of those trace elements. And beyond direct study, there's compelling, though sometimes circumstantial, evidence suggesting a broader transfer of metallurgical know-how from India to Europe. Benjamin Huntsman's invention of the crucible steel process in England around the 1740s, that was a huge leap forward for European steel quality, allowing for uniform cast steel. And his method melting ingredients in a sailed crucible looks remarkably similar to the Indian Woot's process.
A direct connection,
yeah,
or parallel invention?
It's debated. Whether Huntsman consciously copied Indian methods isn't definitively proven, but the timing and the similarity are striking. Then there's the example of zinc smelting. India had advanced zinc smelting using a retort process at sites like Zawar in Rajasthan, possibly centuries before it was commercially viable in Europe. There's speculation this Indian technology might have influenced William Champion, who established commercial zinc production in Bristol in the mid-18th century. So it suggests a flow, perhaps slow and indirect sometimes, of advanced metallurgical ideas from east to west.
It's incredible that this Indian technology was so advanced, which makes it even sadder. Why did Wootz production eventually just fade away in India? It seems to have largely disappeared by the late 19th century.
Yeah, the decline and eventual vanishing of large-scale Wootz production in India, really by the 1870s or so, was a complex tragedy driven by multiple factors converging. Colonial policies under British rule were definitely a major factor. Well, starting in the 18th century, the British imposed tariffs and regulations, often designed to favor British industries and suppress potential Indian competition. Tariffs on the export of Indian iron ore, for instance, which was needed for Wootz, choked off some of the vital trade that had sustained the industry for centuries. It wasn't just about controlling trade, it was often about actively undermining local production.
So deliberate economic pressure.
That seems to have been part of it. Then you had the massive impact of the Industrial Revolution in Europe, the development of Huntsman's process, but even more so the later Bessemer converter and Siemens Martin open hearth furnaces. These allowed for the mass production of relatively cheap uniform steel in Europe.
Right. Industrial scale versus artisanal.
Exactly. This European steel flooded global markets. The traditional Indian Wootz process was painstaking, artisanal, produced relatively small quantities, and the ingots were inherently variable and expensive. It just couldn't compete economically with mass-produced bar steel from Britain and elsewhere. Demand for the unique, costly Wootz ingots dried up as cheaper alternatives became available, including, ironically, European pattern-welded blades made from industrial steel that mimicked the look of Damascus. Sources mention smiths in places like Hyderabad struggling to sell their traditional steel against cheap English imports. And as the economics collapsed, the specialized knowledge likely started to disappear too. This was often craft knowledge passed down within families or communities. When there's no market, the transmission breaks down.
Were there other factors besides economics and policy, like conflicts?
Yes, political disruptions played a role. Conflicts like the Anglo-Afghan War in the 1840s disrupted key overland trade routes used to export ingots. The Indian Rebellion of 1857 also caused localized destruction and turmoil, reportedly damaging workshops and shutting down regional trade fairs where the ingots were traded. And even resource access became an issue under colonial administration. Things like forest acts and land revenue acts, particularly in regions like the Nizam's territory, centralized control over forests. This restricted access for local smiths to the specific types of timber they needed in vast quantities to make charcoal, both for fuel and as a crucible ingredient. Control over land and production sites also shifted in some areas, like Konasamudram, potentially disrupting the traditional systems. By the 1870s, the physical evidence confirms that archaeologists find abandoned crucible production sites across India and Sri Lanka, littered with broken crucibles. The fires had gone out.
A really poignant end to such an ancient and sophisticated tradition. So fast forward to today. When we see knives or swords advertised as Damascus steel, is that the same stuff? Is it real Wootz?
That's a really key distinction, and it causes a lot of confusion. The vast majority of what's called Damascus steel today is actually modern pattern welding.
Pattern welding? How is that different?
It's a completely different process. Modern pattern welding involves taking layers of two or more different types of steel, usually chosen for contrasting colors when etched, like a high-carbon steel and a steel with nickel in it, say 1084 and 15N20 are common, and forge welding them together. You stack them, heat them, hammer them until they fuse. Then you fold the stack, weld it again, fold it again, maybe twist it or cut into it, repeating this many times.
Building up layers.
Exactly. Building up hundreds or even thousands of layers. This creates intricate patterns that are revealed when you etch the finished blade. It can look absolutely stunning, and it's a highly skilled craft in itself. But it's fundamentally different from historical Wootz.
So what was that rule of thumb you mentioned?
The simple way to remember it. One melt, one metal. That's original Wootz, made from a single ingot cast in one crucible. Many layers, many alloys, that's modern or historical pattern welding, mechanically combining different steels. And it's worth remembering, pattern welding was done historically too, in Viking swords, for instance, and even in India for things like gun barrels. But it's not the same as crucible Wootz steel.
But has modern science finally cracked the code? Do we now understand exactly how Wootz was made, the secrets Faraday was chasing?
We've made huge strides, yes. especially in the last few decades of the 20th century and into the 21st. Researchers like John Verhoeven, Alfred Sherby, Jeffrey Wadsworth, David Pendray, Thelma Lowe, Sharada Srinivasan, building on earlier work, of course, have done incredible metallurgical detective work.
What do they figure out?
They've largely decoded the key elements. They confirmed the critical role of that specific ultra-high carbon content. They figured out the importance of the slow cooling within the crucible for forming that initial dendritic structure. They nailed down the crucial effect of those trace elements, vanadium, molybdenum, maybe others, in controlling how the carbides form and align. And they verified the necessity of forging the steel within that very specific narrow temperature window, that dull red heat that the ancient smiths knew empirically. Modern work on ultra-high carbon steels, or UHCS, has managed to replicate the microstructures and properties pretty closely when they follow those parameters.
So the myths, like blades cutting through stone,
yeah,
those are definitely just myths.
Oh, absolutely. Modern metallurgy helps us separate the facts from the folklore. Yes, well-made Wootz blades were exceptionally sharp, held an edge well, and had a surprising toughness for such hard steel thanks to that unique microstructure. But the really fantastical claims cutting through stone blocks, effortlessly shearing through other swords, those are firmly in the realm of legend, not reality. Physics still applies.
And how does genuine historical Wootz stack up against today's best super steels? Is there still a debate there?
There is, and it's an interesting one you see online among knife enthusiasts and metallurgists. If you take purely objective lab measurements, things like standardized edge retention tests, like Khatri tests, impact toughness, yield strength, many modern high-performance monosteels made with incredibly pure alloys and optimized heat treatments will often outperform historical Wootz samples.
So modern steel is just better.
In those specific, measurable ways, often yes. The argument isn't that Wootz wasn't amazing for its time, it was revolutionary. The debate is more about whether it's objectively the best by modern standards. Some metallurgists argue that the complex patterns in Wootz, or historical pattern welding, were actually brilliant ways ancient smiths compensated for limitations. They were dealing with less pure materials, less precise temperature control. These techniques allowed them to create a composite structure that performed better than a simple blade made from the same, perhaps flawed, starting materials might have. A bit like how Japanese swordsmiths use folding to refine their steel.
Is anyone actually trying to make real crucible Wootz today? The original way?
Yes, definitely. There's a dedicated community of artisans, bladesmiths, and researchers around the world who are actively working to revive the authentic crucible Wootz process. It's incredibly challenging. You need the right raw materials, the right crucible recipes, specific furnace designs, and mastery of those critical temperature controls during both melting and forging. It's a near lost art they're trying to rediscover.
So this is more of an artisanal pursuit now.
Very much so. People making true Wootz today aren't usually doing it to compete on raw performance metrics with the latest powder metallurgy super steels. It's more about the historical significance, the challenge, the connection to that ancient craft, that almost magical process of coaxing that specific structure and pattern out of the crucible. It's about recreating history.
Shifting gears a bit.
Yeah.
Beyond the science and the forging, this material clearly had deep cultural, symbolic, and economic importance too.
Oh, immense importance. Think about India's position. For something like 2,000 years, from maybe 300 BC up to the 17th century, India was a major global center for high-quality steel production and export. This wasn't just a niche product. It contributed significantly to India's economy, its wealth, and its international reputation. Wootz steel was a key element of India's material culture and a high-value commodity in the vast trade networks of the time. It physically connected India to the Middle East and indirectly to Europe through the flow of these valuable ingots.
And the blades made from it, they were clearly more than just tools.
Far more. They were powerful symbols. As we discussed, these were high-status weapons, often associated with royalty, nobility, elite warriors. Possessing a Damascus blade was a sign of wealth and power.
Diplomatic gifts, you mentioned.
Exactly. Highly significant diplomatic gifts exchanged between rulers, carrying immense prestige. And their legendary performance fueled their integration into stories, myths, and folklore across many cultures that encountered them. That added to their mystique and value. And within India, their symbolic role is deeply intertwined with culture. While maybe we don't have as many specific depictions of Wootz blades in ancient Indian art as we might like, the broader tradition of exceptional metalworking is undeniable. You see incredible craftsmanship in related areas like the intricate gold inlay, the Kaftgari, often found on high-quality Indian arms and armor. This points to a culture that deeply valued beautiful, sophisticated metalwork. The use of high-quality steel is implicit in Indian epics and central to martial traditions like Kalaripayattu, where the quality of the weapon is paramount. Wootz was part of this incredibly rich, long-standing heritage of metal mastery in India, standing alongside other amazing achievements like Harappan lost wax bronze casting, the giant Sultan Ganj Buddha, or the stunning Shulanataraja bronzes. India was a powerhouse of diverse metalworking skills.
To really understand this whole story, we have to rely on the evidence. What are the key primary sources and the archaeological finds that scholars have used to piece this together?
It's really a fascinating puzzle pieced together from different kinds of clues. We have textual evidence, starting with ancient inscriptions in India that talk about metalworking, though things like the famous Delhi iron pillar showcase mastery of iron, not specifically Wootz. Then you have those early hints from classical writers, Herodotus maybe mentioning Indian iron arrow tips, Quintus Curtius on that gift of bright iron to Alexander.
And the Arab and Islamic texts seem really vital.
Absolutely crucial. They provide some of the most direct evidence. Writers like Jabir ibn Hayyar, al-Biruni, Idrisi, they explicitly document the export of high-quality steel from India and Sri Lanka, specifically for swords. Then you get texts from places like Damascus itself, Maziad bi Ali, al-Kalkashandi, leaving insights into blade production there, even those strange crucible recipes. Dawood ibn Umar al-Antaki wrote about different iron sources, including Indian steel. Later, European travelers like Seetzen observed metallurgy. Tavernier noted trade issues.
And literary references like Scott's novel.
Right, showing the enduring fascination. And then, underpinning all of this interpretation is the massive body of modern scholarly work. The detailed studies, the translations of ancient texts, the metallurgical analyses by researchers like Smith, Barraclough, Weidman, Lowe, Srinivasan, Verhoeven, Wadsworth, Sherby, Faraday, they're the ones who connect the dots. And then there's the stuff you can actually touch, the archaeological evidence. This provides the tangible link back to the ancient production. We have sites across South India, Kodumanal, Melsur Velour, Tintini, Machnoor, especially Konasamudram, where archaeologists have found direct physical evidence of crucible steelmaking. Similar sites in Sri Lanka, too, confirming its role mentioned in texts. And sites like Zawar, showing advanced zinc smelting, provide context for India's broader metallurgical expertise.
What kind of evidence did they find at these sites? Old furnaces?
Exactly. Remnants of furnaces, slag heaps, but most importantly, they find the crucibles themselves, large numbers of them. These specialized ceramic pots, thick-walled, heat-resistant, often with features showing they were designed for slow cooling and easy breakage afterwards. And sometimes, the jackpot, ingot fragments, or even whole ingots like that Konasamudram hoard, these are direct proof of the product. They show the shape, the surface patterns, the consistent weight suggesting standardized production. Carbon dating of charcoal from these sites helps pin down the dates. And even cooler, sometimes they find tiny metallic beads, globules of steel trapped inside the glassy, vitrified walls of broken crucibles. Microscopic analysis of these globules confirms they are indeed high-carbon steel, typically 1.3-1.5% carbon, with microstructures like cementite networks around perlite that perfectly match what you'd expect from this crucible process. It's direct metallurgical fingerprinting.
And finally, the finished products, the actual historical blades. Can we still see genuine examples today?
Yes, absolutely. Major museums and collections worldwide have verified historical swords, daggers, and other arms that are either confirmed Wootz or considered highly likely to be made from Indian Wootz ingots. Places like the Higgins Armory Collection, the Met in New York, the British Museum, museums in Krakow, Florence, they hold these incredible artifacts. They're testaments to the skill of both the original Indian steelmakers and the Persian, Arab, or Syrian smiths who forged them.
But you have to be careful distinguishing Wootz from other techniques.
Yes, that's important. As the sources point out, sometimes you'll see artifacts displayed alongside Wootz that use related but different techniques. Beautiful gold Kaftagari inlay is a surface decoration, not the steel itself. Gold damascening is also an inlay technique. And some blades might be historical pattern welding, creating a pattern mechanically, not through the Wootz crucible structure. Examples mentioned in the sources, like a Bara Jamdadu sword from Golconda, might be pattern welded even though the blade is of Indian origin. So distinguishing the base material from decoration or other forging methods is key.
Okay, so let's try and wrap this all up. What's the big picture here?
The big picture, synthesizing all this evidence, is pretty clear, I think. The invention, the development, the early perfection of Wootz steel, this unique ultra-high carbon crucible steel with remarkable properties, and that stunning pattern was a major technological achievement of ancient Indian metallurgists going way back to the mid-first millennium BC.
A genuine Indian innovation.
Absolutely. Produced in specific regions, particularly in the south, this steel then became a vital commodity. It traveled across the known world via complex trade networks, forming the essential raw material that allowed master smiths in the Middle East, especially in places like Damascus, to forge the blades that became legendary.
And the key takeaway, the point we really wanted to get across, is that while the famous name Damascus steel comes from the forging and trading centers, the unique material itself, the woo steel that made it all possible, originated in the crucibles of India. India wasn't just supplying ore, they pioneered the advanced metallurgy.
Exactly. India innovated the material. Others became masters at shaping it into its most famous form. The foundation was Indian.
It really makes you stop and think, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Here we are today with all our advanced materials, science, electron microscopes, computer modeling. We can design alloys atom by atom. And yet, thousands of years ago, artisans in India, using observation, empirical knowledge passed down, working with charcoal, clay, maybe some secret ingredients, they developed a material whose secrets perplexed some of the greatest scientific minds in Europe for centuries.
It's humbling, really. It speaks volumes about pre-industrial ingenuity and the power of empirical knowledge. You think about that seemingly simple mix, iron, carbon, fire, but guided by this incredibly deep understanding, perfected in those humble crucibles. Mm. It didn't just forge weapons that shaped history. It created objects of such enduring beauty and legend that they still capture our imagination today. A legacy literally forged in fire.